Hello and welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I'm your host, Megan Vole.
And I'm your co-host, Mark Ambrosio.
And Mark, I have a science question for you today.
I'm prepared. Okay.
Okay, the big question is, what do you know about black holes?
Okay, to be honest, everyone, I do not know very much about black holes. That said, I know that they are to be avoided. And I don't know when I'll ever come across one, but I know they should be avoided because all my things will just disappear in them and never rematerialize.
And you will become spaghettified.
Yes.
But you know what? It's you know, good. We'll learn today because we're here with my good friend, Farshid Soltani. Thank you for coming in, Farshid.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
And could you just start us off by giving us a really brief summary of what your research is?
Yeah, great. So I work with black holes. And nowadays, black holes are very common astrophysical objects. We have a lot of evidence of their presence in the sky. We took a few good pictures of them. However, it's surprising how much we don't know or not understand about them still. So what is a black hole? Intuitively, a black hole is a region of space-time where the gravitational field is so strong that nothing can escape it, not even light. Now, this is not actually an accurate picture of a black hole. It is technically correct, but this picture we imagine this as in Newtonian physics, where you imagine like emitting, for example, a light ray, and if the gravitational field is so strong, this light ray will start going up, then it will turn around and come down. This is not actually what happens in a black hole. A better understanding, a better picture of what is a black hole is a region of space-time where space falls faster than the speed of light. So if you emit outward a light ray, what happens is that even if the light ray is moving outwards, it will nonetheless be carried inward by the faster-than-light movement of space, and so it will become trapped. This is a black hole. Now, how are black holes formed in our universe? So we see stars in the sky. Mm-hmm. Stars are pretty stable. What happens is that inside stars, there are nuclear reactions that create a pressure. Mm-hmm. And so this pressure balances the pressure of the gravitational field of the mass forming the star. At the end of the life of a star, this nuclear reaction stops. And so there is nothing checking the pressure of the gravitational field. And so the star starts to collapse. If the star is massive enough, this collapse doesn't stop. And so when the matter of the star is concentrated in a small enough region of space-time, a black hole forms. After the black hole is formed, the collapse of the star doesn't stop. And the star collapses until all the mass of the star is contained in a single point of infinite density. Now, this is clearly a problem. Infinity is a mathematical concept that has no counterpart in the physical world. We don't measure infinity. And so this is a breakpoint of the classical theory, and it's called a singular point of space-time.
Farshid, I wonder, so this is very interesting to me, because I know very little about black holes, but I wonder if you could just back it out just a little bit before you go too far into the black hole. And maybe you could just let us know, so what program are you in? Are you in a PhD or a master's? And how far along are you in that program?
Yeah, I'm a PhD in physics, and I'm finishing up. I just submitted my thesis.
Oh, was congratulations. Yeah.
So you really are finishing up.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. So for the benefit of our listeners and ourselves, because I don't know too much about physics, but what does a PhD in physics involve? Like, how do you do your research?
Yeah, you can do it in a lot of different ways. So physics broadly divides in two main areas, theoretical physics and experimental physics. I'm a theoretical physics. So, of course, you can also subdivide theoretical physics in many different branches, but mainly a theoretical physics might work more with pen and paper. I work a lot with just pen and paper. Wow. And maybe with your laptop, with computer software like Mathematica, Laptop, MATLAB and such. An experimental physicist instead would have a laboratory, be in the lab, building his experimental device and machines, instruments, and then actually making experiments.
So being a theoretical physicist, you could potentially, it sounds like you do your, you know, you could do your work, you know, in your dining room or in your office or in a library, as you say, with pen and paper. I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, you could. It's awesome. I love
it. Yeah, it sounds pretty flexible.
Okay, so I'm going to go back into what you were just talking about, which was your research, which is very interesting to me. And I will be honest, the lay summary you sent us, I understood some of it. I understood enough of it. For the benefit of our listeners, though, again, this is a lay audience. You talk a lot about space-time and the star collapsing in on itself and this folding, I believe is the term you used, of space-time. So can you explain that a little more so we can maybe visualize what we're looking at or thinking about?
Yeah, so the concept of space-time is due to Einstein, okay. Of course, as always. And so the Newtonian concept of space and time is that there are absolute concepts. Time is the same for everyone, for every observer. And space is just a sort of empty container where we live in. It's always the same and things happen into it, in it. What Einstein realized is that this concept of simultaneity, time is the same for everyone, is not a true concept of nature. There is no such thing as simultaneity. Different observers will see as simultaneous different sets of events. And so every observer can divide space-time as space and time, but every observer will do it in a different way. So it doesn't really make sense to talk as space and time as separate entities, but there's only a unique four-dimensional object, three dimensions of space and one of time, mm-hmm. that is called space-time. So okay. That is what we mean when we say space-time.
Okay. Okay, no, you have to wrap your head around these concepts, so this is why I'm going to ask you very basic, possibly very simple questions to you, but okay. So space-time is, it sounds to me like you're talking about distances, so someone in one spot might observe time differently than someone in another place. Am I getting there?
Yeah, it's pretty correct. What I forgot to mention is that there's really no unique concept of time. There's not one global time that everybody kind of live in, but for example, it doesn't make any sense to ask ourselves what is happening right now on a distant galaxy. Mm-hmm. There is no right now. There is no unique concept of time for the whole universe. Every observer locally can define his own time, his own space. Things close to us can experience the same time. We all experience the same time. We don't see this concept of space-time. But on large distances and on large scales, this is very important. And we can only talk about space-time globally.
So I found that very interesting. You've mentioned a couple of heavy hitters. So you've alluded to Einstein. And then you've spoken about Newtonian physics.
Yes.
Sir Isaac Newton. How long have we known about black holes? Like, where in that? So between Newton and Einstein, how long have we been aware of black holes?
Well, it's actually quite interesting. So I'm not really sure about the precise history. I know some things which I heard, which I'm not sure about. But what I know is there was a sort of concept before Einstein and before general relativity, there was a sort of concept of something similar to a black hole that was proposed. I don't remember by who, but they were talking about an object so massive that nothing could escape from it. This is not the black hole we know and see today, but it was something similar. The concept was thrown around. Then when Einstein developed this theory of general relativity that described space-time as a four-dimensional curved surface, a few months later, when Einstein published his equations to kind of find the dynamics of space-time, a German physicist, Schwarzschild, find a solution of these equations that describe a black hole. Now, what happens with a black hole is that you can divide space-time as in interior of a black hole and exterior of a black hole, where we live in. Mm-hmm. And the boundary of these two regions is what is called a horizon, the horizon of the black hole. For nearly 60 years, more or less, nobody had any idea that black holes were actually real. They didn't think that the interior of a black hole was actually part of the physical world, because there is actually... So it's very difficult to work with space-time in general relativity, because coordinatized space-time is not as easy as in usual physics. When we think about Newtonian physics, what we did in calculus class in high school, we just have two Cartesian coordinates, x and y. They describe all of space. We can do whatever with them. That's not true in general relativity. And different coordinate system describe different parts of space-time, and you cannot, in general, you cannot have a unique coordinate system for all of space-time. And so for a Schwarzschild solution for a black hole, the coordinate system does not describe well the interior of the horizon. And it has a singularity, which is called a coordinate singularity, because it is not a physical singularity of space-time, like in the interior of the black hole, I said before, but it's just a problem of the coordinates. So there was this singularity, and people thought, okay, this is not physical, there's a singularity of the horizon, we cannot go inside, there's no problem, we can describe the solution outside, we can live outside, everything's good. Then they first realized that instead you can just change coordinates and then also cover the interior of the black hole, and so black holes were physical, real, was Kruskal, I think around 1960, I'm not sure.
So that's very recent, and so it sounds like, so we first became aware in terms of history of ideas before Einstein, but more so since. And so it sounds very recent. And you spoke about how under Newtonian physics, black holes it's almost that they shouldn't exist, if that's fair to say. But what we know now, like, how much of our understanding of black holes is attributed more to, like, more perhaps quantum physics than classical physics?
Yeah. So the understanding we have of black holes is completely in classical physics.
Completely in classical physics.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The pictures we take and what we think happens outside the black hole, which is the region we really know how to describe well, is completely classical physics and is Einstein's general relativity. The problem with this is that, as I was saying before, there are singularities inside the black hole, which say that the classical theory is no longer valid and it's not reliable. And that's the problem. We don't know what happens there. Like, we can see black holes. We know they are almost everywhere in our universe. We still don't know what really happens inside of them. There is where we need to consider quantum physics, specifically the quantum theory of the gravitational field of gravity, to describe what happens. And the problem is we still don't have a unique theory of quantum gravity that everybody agrees on and with which we can do calculations and stuff. So we have a lot of tentative theories that describe very well some aspect of it versus others. And so what we can do is just use these different theories to get a tentative picture of what really happens inside of a black hole. I personally work with a specific theory of quantum gravity known as loop quantum gravity. And what I did for my research is trying to use this theory to see what the quantum nature of the gravitational field inside a black hole, how it is, and what happens inside a black hole.
Okay, so Mark actually touched on the point that I've been waiting to ask you. It's a very big question, and I had a whole conversation with some people in my life about this in preparation for this interview. It sounds to me, you know, we talk about Newton, you talk about Einstein, that along this history of black holes, if we can call it that, there has been this consistent problem of description in that classical physics doesn't exactly have the math that describes precisely what is going on inside the black hole. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you are working with quantum
gravity.
Quantum gravity. Okay. So then that is a subset of quantum physics?
Yes.
Quantum physics. Okay, we're going back to Oppenheimer here. This is my Oppenheimer knowledge. Okay, so, and that we can say is a modern revolution of the 20th century?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
So I don't think I want to ask you to describe quantum feedback loops, but does quantum physics perhaps describe the black holes better than classical physics does?
So what the problem is that we've seen that the classical theory breaks up completely inside a black hole.
Okay.
So we know we cannot use it to get a reliable answer of what happens inside. So we are forced to use the quantum theory. And as I was saying, we don't have a unique quantum theory for the gravitational field. The point is, we realized, as you were saying, at the start of the 20th century, that in the microscopic world, the laws of physics are actually not the same as the classical one, the Newtonian ones, which are deterministic. But microscopic physics is actually described by a new theory called quantum theory, which is actually probabilistic. So this means that while in classical physics, given some initial conditions, there are some equations of motions that I can use to predict what would be some final answer given my initial conditions. You have 100% certainty that this will happen if I have some initial conditions. In quantum theory, this is no longer the case. What happens is that you only have probabilities. So given some initial conditions you know of, you can only predict the probability that something else will happen. You don't know what will happen for sure until you actually make the measurements, do an experiment. And this is very different.
Yeah.
And so what we've seen is that every dynamical object is described actually in the microscopic world by quantum theory. So it is this for elementary particles, all the matter fields we know of. So we expect the same to be true also for the gravitational field. The problem is that all our understanding, at least most of our understanding of quantum physics was born starting from Newtonian physics and then going to quantum. And so the physics of general relativity is still a classical physics, but it's very different from the notion of Newtonian space and time, as we were saying. So all the notions that works very well for the quantum theory of all other fields cannot be applied directly to the gravitational field, to space-time, which is very different. And so new techniques need to be defined and studied to describe the quantum theory of the gravitational field. And we're still not there yet. We still don't have a complete understanding of it.
Okay, so how is this, I'm going to say it wrong, quantum...
Gravity?
Thank you. Yeah. Quantum gravity. How is this applying to your research that you're doing now? And then I'm probably going to follow up with a question related to the theories after the fact, but we'll start with that.
Yeah. So I use a specific tentative theory of quantum gravity called loop quantum gravity to describe what happens inside of a black hole. And so what I find is that if you consider your star collapsing and forming a black hole, inside the black hole, the star doesn't collapse until a singular point, as in the classical case, but instead it reaches a point of minimum radius and maximum density, and then it sort of bounces like a basketball bouncing on the ground, and it starts to expand again. At the same time, the interior of the black hole, but in the exterior of the collapsing star, does sort of the same process, and the geometry sort of transition from a black hole geometry to a white hole geometry. Ooh. Now, a white hole is a gravitational object that can be defined as sort of the opposite of a black hole. So we've seen that a black hole is a region of space-time where space is falling faster than the speed of light. A white hole is a region of space-time where space is expanding faster than the speed of light. So if a black hole is something that you can enter but never exit, once you're in, you remain in. A white hole is something you cannot enter, and if you're in, you're bounded to go outside. So if you throw a light ray inward in the white hole, the faster than light expansion of space will just carry your light ray outside, even if it is moving, it should be moving inward.
Okay, so I really hope this is a dumb question. Would it be fair to say that the black hole and the white hole, they're connected, and there's this basketball process, I'm really reducing that and I apologize,
yes,
happening in between, but the white hole and the black hole, they are connected in some way?
Yes.
Okay. So if I have a black hole here in some region of space, is the white hole in another region of space entirely?
In the same exact spot.
Oh, okay.
Everything
oh.
happens in a unique exterior region. So there's a unique region exterior to both black hole and white hole. And the white hole is just in the future of the black hole, but it's in the same exact distance in space.
It's in the future, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And, of course, in general relativity, times and space work funny, as we were saying. Mm-hmm. So this process is actually very fast if you are inside the hole. So if you enter into the black hole, it turns into a white hole. This process is very fast from the inside. If you're waiting for it to happen in the exterior region, far away from the hole, we're not sure about the time scale, but it's something extremely big, something like billions of times bigger than the age of the universe right now. So this is an extremely, whose process is extremely, the duration of this process is very high.
So Farshid, you spoke about white holes, which that's entirely new to me. And, and even the theory of relativity, I think that takes some wrapping your mind around it. Earlier you spoke about classical physics and Newton, and people know about Newton. But people may not know much about, and people have heard of Einstein, but people may not know much about quantum physics. And what little people hear is it's magic. And or you know what I mean, and you know, or you see something on YouTube about quantum physics and like the ball behaving in ways it shouldn't, or people walking through walls or something,
or Oppenheimer.
Yeah. And what exactly is quantum physics?
Yeah, so it's very counterintuitive, as you were saying. It seems like magic, but there are many properties that are counterintuitive in quantum physics, and different people think that different properties are the actually more important properties, the defining properties of quantum physics. The one from which it takes the name is that if you study the microscopic world, what happens is that in Newtonian physics, in what we experience in our world, most objects have properties that can take values in the real set, like the energy of something can be any possible real value. There's really no limit, no bound. That must be positive, but it can take any value between two given values. In the quantum theory, this is no longer true. So most interaction happen in sort of discrete chunks of energy. So energy is what is called quantized. So there are this small chunk of energy are called quanta. And so interaction, for example, between the electromagnetic field and something else is not described by a continuum, but is actually described as interaction of this discrete chunk of energy, which are called particles. For the case of the electromagnetic field, there are photons. And so one of the defining features of quantum theory is that many properties of the objects we're describing are quantized. They come in discrete sort of chunks. So we expect this to be true also for the gravitational field. So we expect what we see as a continuous space-time in the classical theory is actually formed by discrete chunks of space in the quantum theory. And so what we experience as a continuous space-time is just sort of a lot of very tiny chunks of space put together in such a way that it forms this continuous space-time.
Very cool. Thank you.
So it's a good thing you brought up theory. This is what I struggled with when I was preparing for this interview. So and I'm going to go back to the theoretical aspect of it, just because I come from a field where, you know, we see scientists like you, and we think, okay, they're looking for a way to describe the world, and when that doesn't do it, they adopt a new theory that more accurately does. Now, for me, classical physics does not seem to describe black holes as well as quantum physics. So I guess for me the struggle comes from like, is quantum physics more correct, because you were able to not only math out black holes, but you were also able to get to the point of entry for white holes. So is quantum physics more correct than classical physics, or are we just looking at a different paradigm?
The last thing you said is exactly right. It's really they are meant to describe different aspects of the world. So the classical Newtonian physics work way well in the sort of scale we live in. So what we see around us, the physics we see, can be described very well with classical physics. And I would never use quantum physics to try to describe it. It would be too complicated, too messy. I wouldn't be able to do it. So it works very well and does the job extremely accurately for what we see. If we instead try to describe microscopic sort of physics, then the classical theory, the Newtonian theory, is not good anymore, and I need to use quantum physics. One is tempted to say that, of course, quantum physics is the fundamental theory, the correct theory, and so it's just that the classical theory is wronger, but it's more like they're meant to describe different sort of scales. Okay. And also, coming back to the black holes, classical theory and general relativity describes extremely well everything we were able to probe up until now, describes very well black holes. The pictures we've taken of black holes were all described using the classical theory, so that's very accurate. where it goes wrong is inside the black hole, which is something we can't really probe. We don't have any way to probe it in the next future. And so I don't think it's really fair to say yet that quantum theory describes black holes better than the classical theory. Also because we really don't have a quantum theory of the gravitational fields everybody agrees on. So different people will have different ideas. We'll say, okay, white holes are not really real. They're not really there. This is not going to happen. So there's still a sort of back and forth between people trying to understand what is actually there.
It's very interesting. And it makes sense because even in, like in the social sciences, if you're looking to explain a phenomenon, different explanations will make sense in different contexts. And what you're saying is for the exterior of a black hole, classical physics makes sense. And then for the interior, quantum physics makes sense. So this has been very helpful. And I've learned a lot about black holes, but I'd like to learn a little bit more about Farshi before we wrap up. You mentioned that you're almost, speaking of wrapping up, you're almost done your PhD here at Western in physics. So before you came to Western, where did you do your previous education, your previous post-secondary education?
Yeah, I did both my bachelor and master in Rome, Sapienza University.
Sapienza?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand that's a very prestigious university. What brought you all the way from La Sapienza University in Rome to here, little University of Western Ontario here in London, Ontario? What brought you here?
Yeah, it's really my research. There's the theory in which I work with, loop quantum gravity, there's really a few people in the world that work on it. So there is one working here on Western University.
And is that your advisor?
Yeah, Francesca Vidotto.
Okay, very good. So that brought you, that makes sense because, and for our listeners, a lot of PhD research is compatibility and finding, you know, somebody who you will work well under and then, you know, trying to, you know, solve the proverbial gap on the shelf in terms of academic research.
Yeah.
And just before we wrap up, because I'm getting the hands from Susie, I did want to ask this. You did this math for your project on your dining room table, ? And what do your parents think you do? Because I don't...
I mean, I worked in most places with pen and paper. You can really do everywhere. So sometimes you get inspired in the most random places. So you just need to go with the flow. But yeah, my parents, they don't know much about what I do. They try to be involved. Sometimes they ask, but they don't really follow. And they forget everything I say when the call is over. So
okay.
Whereabouts do your parents live, if you don't mind asking?
In Italy. I'm from Italy.
Because you're Italian. Yeah, very cool. Very cool.
I'm just picturing with this espresso and you're just mapping out. You know, what are you doing? Oh, the math for black holes?
That is accurate. That is how it works.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Farshid.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Farshid. This has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your co-host, Mark Ambrosio, and the other host was Megan Voll. We've been speaking with Farshid Soltani, and this episode was produced by Susie Lee. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at GradCast Radio, and we are now also on TikTok. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western 94.9 FM. You can find all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks again, Farshid.
Thank you for having me.